The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I came down here today much more interested in hearing from you than hearing from myself. So what I thought would be nice is to hear if you have any questions or any concerns that are up for you and that we want to kind of look at through a Buddhist practice lens. And then if there's no questions at all, that's going to be risky for you because because then I'm going to ask you a question. So you'll protect yourself if you ask questions. And if you could use your mic. It's nice if you, when you answer, ask if you would say your name first, so just so we get to know each other a little more. Yes, I wouldn't, I'm surprised. Alex, up in the front here. No?
No, I was just saying, uh-oh.
Uh-oh, oh. you often have, you know, you often have questions, but we won't put you on the spot.
So I have a practical question.
Name?
Elaine McCrite. Do you have any insider tips?
You can hold it up like a box.
Oh, thank you. Do you have any insider tips on how one gets to attend a residence, a retreat at IRC?
How, any insight about how you get to attend the retreats at IRC? Well, there's, I can tell you the secret how to manage to attend it. So there, we have a retreat center in Santa Cruz that holds about 40 retreatants. And one of the heartbreaking things for me is how many people end up on the waiting list for those retreats and don't get in. And I really feel bad about it because, you know, it's, I don't take lightly people's intention to come on retreat. And there's a lot of people, maybe it's even their first interest to be on retreats, who can't come because it's such a long waiting list, and then they lose interest or get discouraged and don't apply again or something. So, but it's the nature of it. So some retreats we've had, before the pandemic, we had some retreats. There were so many people applied that we could have put on six retreats. You know, it was like 260 people applied or something. So, and now it's dropped now considerably since the pandemic. Now, so now there's only about 180 or something. So, we try to address this in various ways. One is the wish to have a second retreat center so we can accommodate people more. And the other is, so the secret, you know, to get in. The secret is that it's a lottery, and if you don't get in on the first time you apply in the lottery, then the next time you apply, the computer remembers you, and you have two tickets for the lottery. The next time you apply, if you didn't get in, you have three tickets. And the next time you don't get in, you have four tickets. The computer doesn't give you any more tickets. However, it pops up on the roster that this person has four tickets. Or sometimes they have four plus. So maybe that's what it says, four plus. And so then if we have four, you know, four plus or something, then we see what we can do to kind of work the system for you, to kind of bypass the lottery or something. So that's just keep applying, but you can't work the system. You can't apply to every retreat to get a lot of tickets, because if you get accepted to a retreat that you can't do, then you start over again at zero tickets. So you can't, you know, just try to work a system. Just only apply for retreats that you can do, and that's, you know, so eventually you'll get accepted. So I'm very apologetic that it's that difficult and you have to try so many times. But if you persist, that it will. And it's difficult for some people. Some people can't persist. Their life changes, their work changes, and so to be able to be free and plan ahead is hard. So I feel very apologetic and...
So thank you. May I add a related question? So I have done and really feel grateful for the online retreats
Yes.
I've done. So, and I'm sure it varies enormously, but could you sort of, what's your sense of the depth of both the residents
the depth
and the online retreats?
Ah. Oh, I love online retreats. This is one of the great gifts of the pandemic, when we couldn't do residential retreats, and we offered a lot of online retreats here. And before the pandemic, if you had said, like, you're going to be on YouTube, or you're going to be, you know, these online retreats, you know, I kind of, like, didn't believe in them. I'm a little bit of a Luddite, or, you know, having computers. Look, I have I used to, sometimes if I brought an iPhone or phone into the Dharma Hall, I'd hide it from people. And a little bit hiding it behind the bell, but, you know, it's like, you know, I think the last time I was here, I even pulled it out to read a quote. So things have changed. And so one of the things that happened in the pandemic is that I learned how profound these online retreats are. And I think they're really significant. I feel like what I learned from doing many of them, it's kind of the missing link in our practice world. Because some people go on retreat, and they have a certain significant level of experience on retreat, but they don't learn really how to apply that or integrate it into their lives. And there becomes a split between retreat practice, where they have certain depths, and everyday life, where they go home and they're just, I don't know, they're business as usual at home. But when people did the online retreats, most people practice from home, and even sometimes with family members or housemates in the house. And so learning how to harmonize with home life, learning how when there's a plumbing leak, there's, you know, that you have to call a plumber during the retreat, and how do you do that? How do you take the trash out so it's part of the retreat? How do you... It was fascinating at the beginning of the online retreats to have all these things that took people away from their home, you know, out of the practice in a sense. So, for example, there'd be someone, a family member somewhere else was having some crisis and they had to go to the hospital, or there were family members in other countries that were having challenges and they had to address it that they probably wouldn't have done if they were in person at the retreat center. And I just delighted and felt, oh, the retreat just got bigger. And I told people, you're not leaving the retreat. You're taking the retreat with you. And you're expanding what we understand retreat practice to be for all of us. That now you're, you know, taking care of someone in India, or taking care of someone in the hospital, or your neighbor, or you're taking care of the plumber who comes. You're practicing with that. And so that's the missing link. So then people who practice at home got a sense of what it's like to engage in some serious kind of presence, mindfulness, care, compassion, love with the life at home, and harmonize their practice with life kind of in home in a way that they didn't really figure out how to do by going on retreat away and then coming back. So I strongly encourage home retreats. And the other thing I was surprised by, there were some people who did... their very first retreats was online. And I thought, well, how's that going to work? You know, they're home, they don't have the example of the other practitioners on a retreat, and I don't know. Will they have the discipline? And it was phenomenal, the discipline people had and how much people gave themselves to it wholeheartedly. And I was so inspired by people's intentionality and dedication and how transformed they were. So that's the other maybe secret. If you don't get into IRC retreats, don't worry. Just do the online retreat. It's those are much easier to get into.
Thank you.
To bounce off of that question, and I certainly really concur. The online retreats were tremendous, but you were one of the few people who offers them. Some of the other retreats we don't have online, and I know you have to have practice leader discussions and things like that. Is it possible to give this talk to some of the other teachers that you just gave us, because to let them know how important and beneficial the online retreats are?
Great. So our ability to offer online retreat. Right now, what we do, we don't really offer any more online retreats that are only online retreats. What we're offering now is hybrid retreats, and so we're offering. What that means is that there's an in-person retreat, and at the same time, it's being broadcast for the people who are on the online version of it, and then we have the teachers that are teaching in person are giving the teachings for everyone online and in person, but the practice discussions that happen one-on-one with a teacher or in a group setting with a teacher, it's a separate teacher who's not there who offers the group practice discussion, individual practice period for the online people. So that's what we're doing now. So the issue, there's two issues that we have with offering more. One is, in order for us to offer more of these online retreats, we have to have more service leaders. Everything's run by volunteers, and we're actually stretched to the limit and probably more than we should in the available volunteer efforts. We have fantastic volunteers as service managers and tech people and at the retreat center for cooks and managing. And so it's amazing what we have and the goodwill that they carry on their volunteer work and helping everyone. But we have a limited number. And so we can't offer all the retreats we want because we don't have the resources, people resources for it. So that's one. And then the other thing, which is maybe influences it a little bit, is that, and this is kind of difficult to say and awkward for me or uncomfortable for me in many ways, so you'll see me uncomfortable kind of. And that is that people want to sign up with the retreats that I'm doing, not so much for other teachers, for online. We have great teachers, but then if we don't have enough people signing up, then it just kind of doesn't quite work. Or the service leaders are not as interested in volunteering for the other teachers. So that's kind of sad, but very human, I guess, that there's that kind of issue going on. And so both those issues, if they can be addressed, then we'll try to offer more. So... Well, the other way you can get into retreats at IRC, if you're able to, another secret, is if you can be available the last day or very close to the beginning of the retreat, like the few days before, by that time, very few people can be available at short notice. So we'll go through the waiting list very fast. So you could be like 120th in the waiting list and sometimes get in if you're able to get in, you know, keep your calendars clear. But, you know, it was no guarantee. So it's, you know, that's awkward to keep your calendar clear but then not get in. Conrad?
Good morning, everyone. My name's Conrad. I don't know if I have a question, and I'm going to explore something out loud with everyone, but what's been on my mind and heart is loneliness. And I just graduated from the IMC's chaplaincy program, and I've been working across the street and in assisted care living with a group of people. And there is a deep need for connection. This is what's kind of going on in my life. And I had a friend commit suicide last week. And I think what's on my heart is engaged Buddhism. And I think there's this tendency for us to want to kind of chase enlightenment or awakened states. And I think this is good. I kind of want to make a pitch and see if there's anyone who's actually interested in, I might set up a volunteer network to go and we can just read to the elderly, those who have dementia, just sit with them. And it's an opportunity for us to practice engaging with aging, sickness, and death. Three of our greatest teachers in Buddhism, right? And I think there was a question originally here, but I'm kind of pitching it out loud as I'm talking about it because of that need, and that's what's on my heart. So I'm just kind of curious. You don't have to raise your hand. You could come afterwards and chat with me if there's something you might be interested in engaging with. I'll wait and show out afterwards. But that's what's on my heart. I wanted to start with the Sangha. Great. So thank you all.
Okay, well, thank you, Conrad, very much. And I'd like to say that that the art of this... I mean, this is kind of like a dream come true that you would be interested in this and interested to see what this comes out of our community, that people would do that kind of engagement and bring their practice into the world that way. And so that's just, you know, fantastic. It's an important part of what I've wanted us to be about. But and I've kind of been waiting a little bit for people to come and do this, because there's a limited amount how much it can come or should come from the leadership here at IMC. And so to have it come out of the community, it's much better. And part of the art of this is to let it be an inspiration and generosity and love that people want to do, and not to be obligation, not to be a should, but rather really feel that inner inspiration to do this kind of outreach in the world. And that's my hope, that as people practice deeper and deeper and go on retreats and things like that, that it becomes more and more natural to start living in the world with this generous spirit, this compassionate spirit, and that we will be agents to change the society. The society, we know, it needs dramatic changes in so many different ways. And there's way too much poverty and racism and oppression and discrimination and of course, the political divisiveness. And so there's all these issues that we should be addressing. And one of the ways that, there's a number of things we are doing at IMC that comes out of IMC, but they're done kind of quietly. And like one of them is we have a chaplaincy program training that Conrad has just finished. That's why he did his training, and now because he did that, he got invited across the street at the nursing home there to come and care for someone. And now he's coming, that inspired him even more to do more of this. And
I love that idea, and I would be happy to help. But I do also have a question that kind of relates to the idea of aging. So my name is Amanda, and I recently started to explore Buddhism and spirituality about 8 years ago when my dad died and I had a child. So that was an interesting time in my life. And I've since then really feared death. And I've always tried to figure out how to manage that, and this idea of living in the life or living in the moment and focusing on the now. But what's interesting for me is I have two experiences in my life that always make me fear death more, and they're the two things I love the most, which is travel and the ocean. So anytime I'm on a plane or anytime I'm in the water, I always think about dying, and it's so overwhelming for me. And I was just wondering if, from a Buddhist perspective, you had any approaches I could take in my mind in those moments, because I'm in the water, I'm like, shark, 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 shark. And I know the chance is so small. And the same thing on a plane. I mean, there's a bump and I'm like, this is it, this is it. And it's really bad if I'm alone. So I fear getting on planes by myself. And in the water, I always want my child to come with me, because then I take on this motherly role and I'm not afraid because I'm protecting them. But just anything, any suggestions you would have in terms of what I could say to myself in those moments so that this idea of a death in a situation where it's not going to happen doesn't consume me so significantly.
I love the question, and I feel like I want to be careful how I answer it. So I don't know, maybe I'll speak too much, but let's see what comes out. In a number of languages, including in the Buddhist language Pali, the word for fear is very etymologically, kind of linguistically connected to the word for danger. In my language that I grew up in, Norwegian, the word, English word fear is related to the pronunciation in Norwegian is danger. And fear comes from the word danger. And etymologically in Pali, the word bhaya means fear, but also in context means danger. There are real dangers in this world. And to have some concern, some fear around dangers in the world is probably completely appropriate. And the Buddhism has never said you're not supposed to be afraid. Like, there's all these things that Buddhism clearly wants to you to overcome. Greed, hatred, delusion. Like, that's supposed to be uprooted. But there's no idea you're supposed to uproot fear. So there's a kind of the idea of respecting fear, even have a reverence to fear. Lately, I've been reading some people's idea of reverential fear, that especially in terms of the natural world. So a reverential fear of the ocean, and then there's phobia of the fear, which is very different. And the difference, I think, is that one is out of respect. The reverential fear is out of respect for it and care, taking something important. But then if it's an excessive kind of horror at the dangers of the world, that because we're so intimidated or so fragile or tender in ourselves, then maybe it's time to look at ourselves more. And so some fear of airplanes seems reasonable to me. Some fear of being on the ocean, I think, is very reasonable to me. I once sailed on a sailboat across the Atlantic, and the year before, I knew for a year I was going to do that. And I would have a certain kind of reverential fear of doing that. And I would actually go down to, it was Atlantic, but I went living on the Pacific, so I would go to the Pacific sometimes and have a little conversation with the ocean and to kind of prepare myself or address it or something, and to be ready to go. So one thing is to learn how the appropriate fear, how to just be a companion, let it be a companion, and learn how to let it be on your left shoulder, and it comes tags along, and it's just there to help you be safe. And it's not a symptom of something that's necessarily wrong. It might be a symptom of something that's right, and maybe even a deep kind of wisdom connection to the natural world, that there are dangers and we have to be respectful of them and find a way to live in harmony with them. But then if it's excessive fear that really paralyzes us, then it's probably something that really deep we need to attend to in ourselves. And and so it's appropriate to really spend time with your fear, if you're able to. Some people go into panic, some people with trauma, their fear triggers them and worse. And so then it's helpful to have support from others, to have other people accompany you and help you with the psychological tools to really be with the fear. But if you're able to be with your... So this practice here is a practice not to avoid fear, but to practice in the middle of the fear. If we have the right balanced middle way to do that. So look for opportunities to be afraid this way. Take lots of plane trips alone. and sit with your eyes closed and really take in the fear. Really be with it. And if you have the tolerance, the capacity to stay with it without spinning out, then the task is to help the fear feel safe. And that's kind of counterintuitive for some people because, you know, the fear is just fear. But when it's deep roots in our own fragility, our own tenderness, sometimes it has to do with even sometimes our life experiences growing up or other times where we learn that somehow we to have an excessive fear or reactivity to things that were dangerous. And so to help the fear feel safe allows the fear to begin to relax. But if we're trying to fix the fear or solve the fear or psychoanalyze the fear, it's not going to feel safe. So to look for an opportunity to have some of that fear, maybe, you know, go find a boat that's docked somewhere, you know, in the somewhere, and just sit on the boat, and that's, you know, it's not going to go anywhere. It's well moored. Maybe it feels safe enough, but maybe just enough of the fear comes up. And then sit with the fear and see what happens. There might be layers and layers of your emotions, your beliefs, your attachments that are waiting for you to be discovered underneath that fear. And you might find that the issue is not the fear, but the issue might be the fear of the ocean. It might be that... you're afraid of dying, but maybe you're afraid of the pain of dying. Oh no, it's going to be terrible. Drowning must be awful. But it's not, you're not afraid of being dead, but it's the how. And so, you know, but even that opens a door for some people to kind of begin finding other relationships to it. Or it's fear of leaving my kid behind. I mean, I think a primordial fear of a parent is dying before the kid has grown up. And that's reasonable. But then how do we learn to hold it? If you help the fear feel safe so it can be there, then we can maybe learn to have the fear accompany us and not limit us. Accompany us, but not give rise to anxiety. Fear, but no anxiety. Fear, but no freezing up. Fear, but no agitation. And then I think if we learn to have this wise relationship to fear, then by osmosis, the people around us, especially our children, can feel, oh, this world is not such a scary place. But if the parents are really scared all the time, anxious all the time, then at the very young age, the kids learn that this world is a dangerous place, and they grow up anxious. And the earlier they pick that up, or any of us pick this up in childhood, the deeper it's rooted in our hearts. So then it takes a while for, if you do use meditation practice to kind of get to the root of it, it takes a while to settle. So that was a long answer. You think that, are you satisfied with that answer? Is that, yeah? You're satisfied?
I want to sit with it.
Okay, good.
My name's Caitlin. This will make my relationship sound a lot worse than it is, but I've noticed over time that while my husband and I are still growing, we seem to be growing maybe in different directions a little bit, and I find more distance kind of between us. And I guess my question is, how do we ensure that we still grow together at the same time?
Well, I think the primary way is to be honest about it. So be honest about it and find a way to accept each other as you are. And if you can't accept something, to be honest about that and find your way with that. I'm a great believer in talking and being honest and exploring it that way. But saying it that simply as I just did indicate that sometimes these conversations are very difficult to have, and that people might, and very, some people don't want to have those conversations. And so, what do you do when one of the parties doesn't, is not capable of those conversations, doesn't want to do those conversations? And then you have to have this conversation in a stealth way, you know, indirectly, or you have to figure out what does the other party need to hear or need to relax and to feel safe or feel heard or feel, you know, so that there can be some space for a little bit of a truth-telling to go on. And sometimes if the other party doesn't want to grow or doesn't want to talk about something, then sometimes the person who wants to grow, it can be useful to go talk to a therapist who's a couple counselor and really start looking at what's going on for you. Because I think one of the great tasks of any relationship, at least from a Buddhist point of view, is how do you keep your heart completely open regardless of what's happening to the other person? And so that's a personal exercise. And there's a lot of challenges to that. But I think Buddhist practice, it's like, let's say we're up, let's be up to that challenge. Let me keep my heart open no matter what. It doesn't mean that we don't set boundaries. It doesn't mean we don't say no. It doesn't mean we don't take care of ourselves. But to always have this orientation, how do I keep my heart open here in these challenges? So that's the personal work that can be done. And then if you understand each other, if you understand that if you both agree to understand each other. Oh, this is the other thing. If someone doesn't want to talk to you about their relationship, what's going on, then become a really good listener. Offer to the other person what you wish they would give to you. And so and sometimes that's a stealth way. Just really listen and make sure they feel it, understood that they have been heard. And then something sometimes can relax in the other person, that then they become interested in you. So these are just ideas that may or may not work, but I love that you're asking the question, because this is probably important in many, many relationships. So is this satisfying enough now?
Yeah.
I'm not that satisfied with my answer, but but is this satisfying enough for now?
I mean, that's more or less what I concluded myself, so
yeah. You already thought about all these things?
Somewhat, yeah.
Yeah, well, then it's not satisfying.
Thanks. My name is Steve. Recently, earlier this summer, I attended a retreat, a three-week retreat, in a different tradition, in a Shambhala Tibetan tradition, and which I found very interesting and very useful. And I was wondering if you could speak just a little bit about sort of mixing practices in different uh-huh. Buddhist traditions.
Great, thank you. So I've done that. I mean, my first training was in Zen, Japanese Zen. I did that for many years. That became a foundation for me to do the Vipassana practice. So I benefited a lot from doing both. And so that's not exactly mixing, but it's how they work together. And often, if you've been in one tradition for a while, if you go study with another Buddhist tradition, or even another form of spirituality, religion even, that it can help you then look back at the practice tradition you've been in and see it in new ways. And some of it you might see how beneficial it was, you might see how it really works well, and you might see, that there are challenges there for me, that's maybe not quite right for me, but there's a deeper understanding. So I think I often like to suggest to people, if they've done a good number of years in one Buddhist tradition, step outside for a little bit. Do something else in order to get a better perspective of the tradition. You can come back to your tradition, but you maybe have a richer, better perspective of it. The question is about different Buddhist traditions, right? Some Buddhist traditions complement each other. I think every Buddhist tradition, every Buddhist center, every Buddhist teacher has strengths and weaknesses. I can't imagine that doesn't work everywhere. I mean, in spite of what people think. And so you take the strengths that are there and benefit from them. And if you feel there's a weakness, then that's where going someplace else can complement it. So in our Vipassana tradition, we have a strong tendency to encouragement to practice with different teachers. And I like to think of the different kind of circle of teachers as being that's the whole package. And so you want to go and practice with different teachers because they have different ways of different teachings, different strengths that they're offering. And it's the total package that is nice, not just always with one teacher. And so with different Buddhist traditions as well. And so I've known people who have practiced here at IMC or practiced with the San Francisco Zen Center that they'll go to the other one and find it really beneficial. Some people have done a lot of Vipassana practice, then gone to the San Francisco Zen Center because it's close by, and they found that practicing in community there in a semi-monastic setting was really a significant complement for what we do here. And I've known Zen students who have found that coming here was a really great complement for what they learned at Zen Center. So there's all kinds of ways that they support each other and work. And the one thing that I would warn about that is against bouncing back and forth too much. And especially if you're a new practitioner. For someone who's relatively new to practice, I'd recommend that you stay in one tradition like at least for in a good strong way, at least for a year, because the things that people are working through the first year or so of Buddhist practice is kind of the same for everyone, and it doesn't really matter so much who you're practicing with, and once you've worked through the hindrances enough, or your mind has learned to be not so distracted and so agitated, and you're quieter, and you have some kind of inner connection to the Dharma now from practicing, then you have a different eye to understand the different traditions. So after a year of practice, you might come up, surface, and look around and check out the different traditions, see which one feels like it really works for you, is best for you. And you might decide, well, I'm staying here where I am, or say, oh, that was great, thank you, but now I'm going to go do something else. So is that...
Yeah.
Okay. So Will, in the back. If you wait for the mic.
Hi, I'm Will. I was wondering, how do you maintain hope in the face of an ever-changing world?
How do you maintain hope and faith in an ever-changing world? It's a great question. Buddhism puts tremendous emphasis on the fact that we live in an ever-changing world. So one of the ways to do it is don't hold on to hope and faith, but take a very honest look at the hopelessness and the faithlessness. Where does that need for hope and faith come from in you? What's the sense of despair or anxiety or hopelessness? What's really happening deep inside? Because addressing that might be more important than provide. Some people get hope, and what they're doing is they're just laying it on top of their hopelessness, and not really addressing the hopelessness. It's kind of like, and for a while people get inspired. They hear some wonderful teaching or some wonderful, that's the solution, that's the hope, but they haven't really dipped down to what was going on deeper inside. So that's at least in our tradition. I think the emphasis would be, let's take a deeper look what's underneath there before you look for hope and faith. And one of the remarkable things that can happen there is that I don't know you well enough to know if this speaks for you, but just keep that in mind. It's not a statement about you. But the hopelessness and a feeling, a sense of, you know, faithlessness or deep doubt or something are not the absence of something. They are activities themselves. They're mental actions that are happening. The mind is doing something to provide, or the heart's doing something to well up a feeling of hopelessness. The mind, the heart is doing something to I have no faith in anything. It feels like there's an absence, but that sense of absence or that sense of loneliness that Conrad brought up, or that sense of meaninglessness, or that sense of despair that people can have, those are all activities of the mind. There's energy, there's activity doing something. And because it's an activity, before it has its dynamic and mental process, it doesn't have to be there. It can be settled. It can be addressed directly. It can be, as it feels safe, as it feels met, as it feels understood and seen. It's just like with the fear. Remarkably, it can begin to settle and unravel. So that, as I like to say, some of our problems will not be solved, they will be dissolved. So something like a feeling of hopelessness doesn't need to discover something to have hope in. It turns out hopelessness itself can dissolve, and then there's no need for hope. That's pretty radical, isn't it? So I'm not asking you if that was a satisfying answer, but does my answer intrigue you?
I think what you said was true.
Sorry, wait, wait.
I think what you said was true.
Okay, great. So, okay, thank you. So I saw, I think this person over here was first, and then...
Hi, my name is Fawad. This has been such a beautiful question asked. I'm asking a very mundane question, which is really more about practice. I've had attention deficit most of my life, and so I particularly struggle as I meditate with concentration, And I tend not to be hard on myself about it or any such thing. I think I'm good with it, but would still really appreciate if there is if there are things that I could do to bring more concentration into the meditation. So sometimes, even a half-hour session, I'll feel no more than a minute or two of having been able to focus on the breath. Periodically, I'll gently bring my attention back. But concentration feels to me, I can't speak for anyone else's subjective experience, more of a challenge for me. Yeah. Are there ways I can work on it?
So I think that's a profound question. Thank you. Nothing mundane. Thank you. And there's lots to be said. So I don't know what to say to you that would meet your circumstance, but I'll try to say something. That it's a little bit unfortunate that the word samadhi is translated into English as concentration, because it's all too easy for people with the word concentration to think that they need to kind of now like have a laser focus on something, and it's a kind of a mental kind of act of kind of zeroing in, kind of, you know, like maybe, you know, there are times we have to do that in life, but so it's, that reinforces the idea that that's what we're supposed to do in meditation. The word samadhi can also kind of mean unification. And I like to think of samadhi as the process of becoming whole. So if the task is to become whole, as opposed to the task is to become zero, like a laser, what does it take to become whole? And how do we become whole so that the mind is not jumping around, distracting us from that whole? Because then as soon as we're distracted, we become partial. We're not whole anymore. So one of the ways to become concentrated is in this holistic way is not to focus on anything, but to rest on it. So with the breathing, rest on the breathing. And or to be even more kind of specific and helpful, maybe, is think of the that as you imagine as you inhale, breathing is focusing on you, is arriving and wants to is making contact with you. And the exhale, you're offering yourself to the breathing, and you just rest with the exhale. So receive the inhale and then just rest there with the outhale. And that's where the resting can be. And then over time, that resting might begin opening up a little bit sense of wholeness, sense of inclusion in the experience. And so then that sense of inclusion of the present moment begins to spread out to include more and more. And you have a feeling that everything's included. And then when the mind starts going off into its thoughts, when there's kind of a strong sense of wholeness or inclusion, it's like, oh, look at that. The mind is wandering off, but I'm not wandering off. The mind is thinking, but I'm not living in the thought. I'm not identified with it. It's just, oh, and then sometimes you'll see the thought just arise, and you watch it, you know, come, and you really have a clear sense of being a watcher or being clear mindful of it. And it just kind of dissolves. It's kind of like a cloud that dissolves in the sky because you're not participating in it. You're not feeding it. And so does that intrigue you?
Definitely. That was quite helpful. I do tend to, I think of concentration as the inhales and the exhales, and that resting concept really intrigues me. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So it's kind of time to stop, but I saw a couple of people want to ask a question. So what I'd like to propose is that let's take a little, you know, even just a two-minute break. If some of you are ready to leave now, please, and thank you for being here. And if some of you would like to stay to continue this kind of questions, just maybe come up closer or just stay where you are, and then we'll continue in about two, 3 minutes or so. So thank you, everyone.